I have the great pleasure of introducing Kevin Gallagher, who is a political economist, poet, and publisher living in Greater Boston with his wife, Kelly, their children, Theo and Estelle, and Rexroth, the family German Shepherd. Gallagher is the author of 4 chapbooks of poetry and has 2 forthcoming full-length collections, The Loom, from which he will read tonight, and Mass and Beacon. He edits Spoke, a Boston-based annual of poetry and poetics, and works as a professor of global development policy at Boston University's Pardee School for Global Studies. His new book on global development is The China Triangle, Latin America's China Boom and the Fate of the Washington Consensus. I met Kevin back in 1994 when we were students at the Joyner Center for the Study of War and Social Consequences. And he and his colleagues were publishing this fantastic magazine called Compost Magazine, in which I was published. I had the good fortune of being published. And I've had the pleasure and honor of seeing Kevin develop from that young Turk back in 1994 to this incredible publisher and poet and scholar. And so it is a real thrill to introduce my colleague and friend, Kevin Gallagher.
So the name of the book is called Loom. And it's set in antebellum Boston in between the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. And it's inspired from, adapted from, diaries, letters, and memoirs from Boston elite, Southern slaveholders, workers in textile factories in Lowell and Lawrence. And I guess it's a poem or a sequence of poems that tells the epic story of one time in our history that I'm aware of, where the most powerful people in the United States, people with the most wealth and power in the history of the United States, acted against their material interest and to their own material detriment to make a huge change, and that's basically finance abolitionism and the 54th Regiment and John Brown's raids in Kansas. While just 5 years beforehand, they were actually dragging William Lloyd Garrison through the streets of Boston. I wrote this, I was living in Washington for a year. I've lived in Boston all my life, but I always go away for a year or two here. I was living in Washington, and I used to drive through Baltimore all the time during the riots. And I'm a poet, and I'm a political economist, but I can't write political poetry the way some people can. And I thought about how did Charles Olson think about these kind of things? How would William Carlos Williams and Muriel Rukeyser, they would go into history? And so I went to the Library of Congress and started reading. I went to the Boston Athenaeum and the Massachusetts Historical Society and the Boston Public Library. And these poems are adaptions, like I said. And I'm also fortunate to have gotten permission from a lot of these libraries to have engravings and prints from the period throughout the book. So it should come out. It'll be out in the fall, and I'll start reading from it. The story of the poem and really of America as we know it starts with Francis Cabot Lowell. Francis Cabot Lowell is the same Lowell who's 2 generations later was Henry Cabot Lowell, the romantic poet. A few generations after that was Lowell, the president of Harvard, who played the terrible role that he did during the Sacco and Vanzetti trials. And a few generations after that was Robert Lowell, the poet. But Francis Cabot Lowell, in about 1811 and 1812, had an idea. He was a merchant banker living in Boston, and had heard about these power looms that they had in the UK. And they wouldn't let any, you know, they had really tight intellectual property rules at the time, as we do here. And it was really hard to get the plans, but he really wanted to be able to get the plans because he knew he could make a ton of money here in the United States if we had that kind of technology. And he, as a merchant in Boston, was importing a lot of cloth and textiles and clothing from the UK during, you know, their industrial boom. And so he said right before the war of 1812, he flew out to Leicester and to Manchester and went up to these guys that he was purchasing all these textiles from and said, "Gosh, I just got to see these machines. These things are incredible. I just have to see him. And he had a photographic memory, and he stole the plans of the power loom. And then noticed that there was great hydropower up on the Merrimack in Lowell and Lawrence, and built all those factories up in Lowell and Lawrence, named one town after himself, named another town after his co-financier, Amos Lawrence, and another guy, Appleton, was another key financier of it. You see his name all over the time. And that was the transformation of the United States economy from an agricultural economy to an industrial powerhouse. And I'll tell you more of the story. So the first poem is a letter from Francis Cabot Lowell to Nathan Appleton called Pirating the Power Loom. I stole their designs with my own two eyes. I smuggled them to Boston in my mind. Exporting designs meant jail in Britain. Workers of the looms weren't allowed to leave. So I snuck into Manchester myself. I made it back 2 days before the war. I saw iron cards and spinning jennies. I watched Luddites spin and weave all alone while the looms marched in teams and didn't rest. I said to myself, these things have to come home. My baggage was searched twice at Halifax. They didn't find drawings of their machines. I sketched it all out in my memory. I had their designs in my head with me. One of the things that he observed were the big strikes that were in the UK during the time. And he said, I don't want to have that. And so he came out with an ingenious idea to him, which is, I'm going to get the women who work in the farms in New England, who are much more docile and would never strike, to come and work in these things. If you go to the Lowell National Historic Park, where I'm actually going to give a reading, they have a video about how enlightened these guys were because they employed women, which on the one hand, the counterfactual is that they had a better working life on some levels and their own cash to be able to do what they wanted to relative to what they were doing when their dad was telling them to be out in the farms 5 days a week, 10 days a week. But it wasn't exactly that. So this poem is called Girl Power, and this is from a letter that Francis Cabot Lowell wrote to Paul Moody, the engineer who took his plans from his head and turned it into these machines. I teamed up with my old friend Henry Lee. We put $8,000 down for cotton plantations in South Carolina. We saw the money that was in the cotton gin. We see even more in our new machines. With the war, the South has nowhere else to go. Against next year's crops, we can give them loans. Our ships will sail cotton up the coast. Our railroad will roll cotton to the mills. Our rivers will make the water wheels go. Our country girls will man all the looms and turn cotton into cloth under one roof. The girls will feel too fortunate to strike when the wheels will roll, the spindles whirl, and the shuttles fly. There's a famous, one of the famous debates is Jefferson's vision of what an economy should look like and Hamilton's. Hamilton's was a big industrialist. Jefferson wanted small-scale family, plantation-based agriculture and so forth. And Jefferson was totally against what Hamilton wanted, which is major imports on manufacturing from other countries so that we could build our own industries, except for in the case of textiles in Massachusetts. I have a poem based on his speech where he makes a huge case for what was called the Tariff Act of 1816. And the Tariff Act of 1816 created something that Senator Charles Sumner called the unholy alliance between what he called the Lords of the Loom, the Lowells, Appletons, and Lawrences here in Boston, and the Lords of the Lash. Because with the War of 1812 and no more imports of cloth coming in from India via the United Kingdom, the major source of demand for the power looms in Lowell and Lawrence were southern plantations. And so the Massachusetts-based cotton textiles boom re-energized and transformed slavery in the South, because it was largely tobacco-based, and they converted a lot of the tobacco to cotton. And then, one thing I didn't know until I started doing this research, is that after they maximized all the land in cotton and converted to tobacco, they still needed more because there was ever more demand because they were selling clothes and clothing everybody all over the U.S. and exporting it all around the world. And so the Indian Removal Act of 1830 was basically a function to need more land for textiles and cotton production to be sent up to Lowell and Lawrence. This poem's called Removal Act, 1830. Maize, beans, squash, the three sisters. Rabbit, deer, fish, pots, baskets, clothes. Trade you skins and fur, otter, lynx, fox, for knives, axes, muskets, gunpowder, and scarlet ribbon. Two, we need those unused lands. You better master the arts of civilization or go west of the Mississippi. Three, Alabama, half of Georgia, western Tennessee, the Creeks, Cherokee, Chickasaws, a trail of tears. Four, horses and oxen standing up in the mud, stiff and bones. One wagon for every 50, for children, for elders, for the rest of us on foot in tears. Bayonets at our backs, disease ahead. Five, destined to perpetuate our race, to attest the humanity and justice of these states. I've got a picture of Andrew Jackson that was etched at the time in Harper's Weekly of him on his horse with a sword pushing Native Americans to the west. Here's one that's difficult to read, but what's fascinating is that in the southern plantations, in these cotton plantations, it's the cotton pickers that were on the they had their own social class and of hierarchy within slavery itself, and this one's called the lowest class. There was just two classes to the white folks: buckra slave owners and poor white folks that didn't own no slaves. There was more classes amongst us slaves. The first class was the house servants. Then was the butler, the maids, the nurses, chambermaids, and cooks. The next class was the carriage drivers, the gardeners, the carpenters, the barber, and the stablemen. Then come the next class, the wheelwright, wagoners, blacksmith, slave foreman. The next class I members were the cowmen and the niggers that care for the dogs. All these have good houses, and they never get beaten. Then come the cradlers of the wheat, then the threshers, then come the feeders of the cotton gin. But the lowest class, no question, cotton field niggers. I go through a bunch of poems in here. One of the things that's really fascinating is that most of the slaves wore, I don't know if any of you are watching the remake of Roots that's been back on. You see the sort of traditional shirts that they wear. I didn't know. You know what those are called? That's called Lowell cloth. One of the key exports back to the South were one of the key sources of demand was actually clothing back to the slaves. It's incredible. I got a poem about that. I discovered the way Columbus discovered America. I discovered this woman poet named Lucy Larcom, who's Beverly born, and she was a worker in the mills, in the cotton mills. One of these women mill workers, and they had their own literary magazine called the Lowell Offering up there, She wrote this famous memoir and a bunch of book of poems, and she was somewhat agnostic. She was somewhat of a defender of what it was all about, because she said, you know, if you imagine what I would be doing on my dad's farm, I had freedom, I had my own money, I could go to the movies at night. But she did write one poem where she did contemplate this broader connection with the South, and this poem's called Lucy Larcom. I ask you how much of your wrong is mine as I change bobbins in the spinning room. As the waters glide and our shuttles fly, you toil in ghastly death-sown fields that lie. All day I stand before a power loom. I ask you how much of your wrong is mine down underneath the southern sky. My family needs me to send money home. As the waters glide and our shuttles fly, it isn't very hard to draw straight lines. I work here 5 years, then I find myself a groom. I ask you, how much of your wrong is mine? I cannot weave when I'm wearing blinds. I'm not alone because I am with you. As the waters glide and the shuttles fly, Clasp my hands and look right in my eyes. You will see the sun of the southern sky. As my shuttle flies and the water glides, I ask you how much of your wrong is mine. So, a whole bunch of other stuff. And then I have a second section of the book, which this is probably the only place where I'll be giving readings on this book, where I won't have to describe where it comes from. The second section of the book is called Polis Was This. Henry's got a great movie called Polis Is This. And Polis Was This. Here's a poem called Turnout. By a woman named Harriet Hanson Robinson, who's well known as one of the most famous early women suffragists in Washington. But she was also got politicized in the mills of Lowell and was a poet. Here's a variation on something that she did with some Langston Hughes in it, too. It's called Turnout, which is what they used to call a strike, turnout. When the cotton is all spun and all our work is done, the boss man takes the money and we get close to none. Now they want to cut our wages, make us pay our own board. We have to show our faces in the name of the Lord. I know what I have to do. I'm going to turn out. And I ask that you will all join me too. March with me and shout, oh, isn't it a pity that such a pretty girl as I should be sent to the factory to pine away and die? Oh, I cannot be a slave, for I am too fond of liberty. I cannot be a slave. No, I cannot be a slave. Right around the same time of this strike, 1830, 1831, is the Nat Turner's Revolt in the South. And John Floyd in 1831 was the governor of Virginia, and he writes a letter to the governor of Massachusetts saying, what the F is going on up there? I call this poem Warning Shots. I lay Nat Turner on Boston's doorstep. Militias now swarm my entire state. We killed 100, and we're going to hunt for more. All of our planters are watching their backs. You must take action or we'll kill more blacks. We pin the blame on the Liberator, that diabolical Boston paper edited by a madman in Merchants Hall. There is too much excitement across the whole South for this illegal notion you call abolition. The Lowell turnout doesn't help. Your Lowell girls sing, or so we're told, that they're so fond of liberty that they can't be a slave. Prepare for some harsh resolutions towards your manufacturers, my friends. You people up north must go to hanging these fanatical wretches, or you will not, you would not lose your southern trade. The governor of Massachusetts writes a letter back saying, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. Don't worry about it. We're not going to do anything about it. And he actually gives a speech at Faneuil Hall. I've got this great picture of Faneuil Hall from 1831 in here. And he gives a speech something like this. It's called Faneuil Hall, Harrison Gray Otis, August 21st, 1835. The 13 stripes in a square of stars can't become dismal strains of black and red. The maniacs call our Constitution a covenant with death, an agreement with hell, and unfathomably deep with pollution. They do not work like Christian gentlemen. They preach for the gospel, they preach for the repeal of our union. I warn them the danger of their meetings about this. They ask for an appeal to a higher law. This is war in disguise upon our lives, a war on poverty, a war on property and faith of contract, an outrage upon our pride and honor. We will never see eye to eye. Stop them from going in that direction. And then the Liberator who they're talking about is William Lloyd Garrison, and he had the famous paper magazine called The Liberator. I've got their masthead here that I got from the Boston Athenaeum. John Greenleaf Whittier was the poetry editor of The Liberator. And this is a poem that Garrison says about when he was dragged through the streets of Boston. Thousands of genteel ruffians called out, lynch him, hang him in the common, turn him into a nigger collar with tar. I ran and jumped out the back window only to land on an even larger mob. The Cooley brothers pinned down my shoulders, then lashed a rope 3 times around my chest. I was dragged through Wilson's Lane to State Street to the spot of the Boston Massacre. They tore off my clothes and they kicked me in the face. The light of day didn't cause them to care, so the mayor jailed me to keep me safe. Another day devoted to thy cause. Not till this war is over will I pause. And what's fascinating is that that act, right, when another white guy that looks just like all these folks gets dragged through the streets of Boston, interestingly, by people in broadcloth, that was like the real nice way that the elites worked, that's when people really started to change their mind. The big party in the United States at the time that was in power was the Whig Party, and the big coalition within the Whig Party was called the Cotton Whigs, the coalition between the Northern Whigs and the Southern Whigs, Cotton Whig, but also Cotton Whig Party. And Wendell Phillips from Massachusetts created a break in the Whig Party basically because of this one moment when Garrison gets dragged through the streets and creates a wing of the party called the Conscience Whigs, which eventually thought they could stay in the party, but eventually left, like as if, you know, Lincoln, this is like Lincoln Chafee coming over to the Democratic Party and joining the Bernie Sanders campaign or something like that. The name of this poem is called This Is No Party, Wendell Phillips, 1835. Gentlemen of broadcloth and broad daylight came from state to Washington Street in a mob. You dragged a man through Boston without rights. These were his unalienable rights. Your mob wasn't working men or rabble, but Brahmins in broadcloth and broad daylight. It was all too clear that this was in their sight. You surrounded him to pummel and rob. You dragged him through the streets without his rights. Never before had I seen such a sight. Never before had my eyes been so sobbed. Gentlemen in broadcloth and broad daylight, you pride yourselves on the prayer you say each night, but deny to protect for anything for your precious cloth. You dragged a man through Boston without right. I stand by him, and from now on I fight until every trace of slavery is gone. How am I doing on time? We're doing like 20 minutes apiece. I've done 10 or something. I forgot to check. I was going to time myself.
Yeah, you're doing good.
Oh, my fellow coach, I'm a baseball coach for my 11-year-old son, he just sent me a text that we won 6-1. Who needs Coach Gallagher? So all sorts of stuff happens in U.S. history during this period. One of the key things is the Compromise of 1850, where there's a big swap, where, you know, there's, by this point, there's massive friction north and south and north and north, and they're all the new territories open up in the West. Some of them get to go to be slave states, some of them not. And one of the key things one of the deal closers is the Fugitive Slave Act. Fugitive Slave Act says, okay, you crazy people from up north who don't like slavery, we'll let you do that, but if one of our slaves from the south comes up there, and we can go up there and get him, and when we get him, we get to bring him back home. That's the Fugitive Slave Act. And the pivotal point in U.S. history on this whole issue is actually the Fugitive Slave Act, because that's the trial of Anthony Burns and the case of Anthony Burns under the Fugitive Slave Act. Here's a picture of him that I got from the Boston Athenaeum. He was a slave who escaped from Alexandria, Virginia, where I was living, where I wrote a lot of this poem, came to Boston and got caught and got tried, and Boston abolitionists literally stormed the court square and the court and literally killed their fellow Americans, to try to free this guy. But it didn't work out, but it worked out in the long run for the country in many ways. Anthony Burns, Boston, May 24th, 1854. I didn't want to make myself known. I didn't tell who I was. I got employed. I came to work. I worked hard. I kept my own counsel. I strove for myself, and I never said I was a slave. I was going home one night. I heard someone behind me. I felt a hand on my shoulder. I heard the cannons, I think, from the common. I hear the Nebraska bill had just passed. Stop, stop. You're the fellow that broke into the silversmith shop. I said he was mistaken. I was lifted off my feet, I think, by 6 or 7 others. I could not resist. I could not speak. I waited in the courthouse. I waited for some time. I said I wanted to go home. I said I just wanted my supper. I waited in jail. And then, how do you do, Mr. Burns? Said the man who opened the door. I said, I am fine, my master. Did I ever whip you, Anthony? I said, no. Did I not, when you were sick, take my bed from my own house for you, Anthony? I said, yes. Did you ever ask me for money when it was not given to you? I said, I do recollect. you gave me 12 and a half cents at the end of every year. I was taken down with bracelets on my wrists, not such as you wear, ladies, of gold and silver. I was taken down with bracelets on my wrists, iron and steel manacles that were bore into my bone. And the city, I have a couple mock handbills. The city of Boston got littered with handbills all over the place where abolitionists were gathering. They heard that one of these fugitive slaves had been caught and that they didn't catch it before it happened, and the guy was in jail. I've got a really interesting etching of that was done at the time of abolitionists, black and white abolitionists from Boston, storming Court Square. Here's the poem about that. It's called Rescue Attempt, Thomas Wentworth Higgins, May 27th, 1854. He was a Unitarian minister.
From Salem.
I didn't know that. He didn't say where he came from in his journals. There is now no law in Massachusetts. When law ceases, we act in sovereignty. We rush State Street in like a sweep of wave. We started breaking out battle axes in a battering ram for the front door. We threw brickbats to break the windows. The guards started shooting us from above. Surrounding crowds screamed, "Take him out, rescue him." Muzzles flashed and pistols cracked behind us. We pounded inside and started stabbing. We killed an Irishman of the marshal's guard. They clubbed us back on the street and with the crowds. Their cutlasses proved too much for us that night. Cowards, would you desert us now? So Anthony Burns loses his case. He gets caught. And the Virginia Cavalry brings hundreds of cavalry to Boston and parades Anthony Burns through the streets of Boston to the port, put him on a ship, take him back to slavery. And that, according to Amos A. Lawrence, who is the son of Amos Lawrence that Lawrence is named after, Amos A. Lawrence, who is the richest man, you know, a Koch brother times 10, says that's the moment when he looked out a window, and there was an etching about it that was in the Boston Pilot at the time, when he looked out the window and he saw that as steeped as he was in the whole political economy of this unholy alliance, as a gentleman, that crossed the line. And he says, that's the moment that I became a stark mad abolitionist. I put my hands in my face and I wept. I had gone to bed an old-fashioned conservative, and I woke up a stark mad abolitionist. Look what you've done. I can do nothing less. You've given me a new purpose to live. I put my hands in my face and I wept, and I put myself into his footsteps. Burns is a hero, not a fugitive. I'm a stark mad abolitionist. I will see to it that we free Kansas. Your betrayal is my strongest motive. I put my hands in my face and I wept, but woke up a new man after I slept. I will give everything I can give. I'm a stark mad abolitionist. Anthony Burns, I will never forget. Stephen Douglas, I will never forgive. I put my hands in my face and I wept, and now I'm a stark mad abolitionist. The lawyer for the abolitionist was a guy named Richard Henry Dana, and Amos Lawrence shows up in Dana's house in the middle of the night after this parade, and he can't believe it. It really is like a Koch brother going to Bill McKibben after a protest on fracking and saying, "I want to finance your campaign." It's called Skunk Peculiarities, Richard Henry Dana, May 26, 1854. I found Amos A. Lawrence at my door last night, a man who has long appeased slave power. He said he wanted to go on record that he changed his mind in the final hour. The man who helped arrest Shadrach, the man who paid to send back Thomas Sims, the man whose textile girls say they are slaves, the man whose mob may have dragged Garrison, told me he will spend whatever it takes to help to defend this fugitive slave. Nebraska and Burns were much too much for him to take. We're no runaway hunting ground, he said. Now we have the solid men of Boston on our side and on the side of freedom. Bunch of poems, and what to me is fascinating, so Lawrence actually does a whole bunch of things. He finances a bunch of secret societies, and the cover of my book, it looks like a baseball bat, and after I told you that my son just won, it's actually a billy club loaded with lead from the Boston Anti-Manhunting League, a secret society led by Henry Bowditch, but they all had secret names, and Amos A. Lawrence was one of the financiers of it. This is I read their minutes at the Massachusetts Historical Society, and this was their formation of how they would surround a slaveholder. If one of these guys came into town, this is how they were going to say, that guy, Dan Cannell's from Virginia, he's here to get his slave, and we're going to surround him, we're going to beat the shit out of him, we're going to send him back to Virginia, and when they see what he looks like, they're not going to send his back. Boston Anti-Manhunting League, Henry Bowditch, 1854. A committee of six, prudent, young, true, and stalwart comrades with one elder speaker, are first to try your hands at reason. And if the southern blood arises, the speaker signals and we begin the snaking out. Keep the slave hunter, S.H., in the center. The committee speaker, S., stays in back. C. member takes hold of the hunter's head. A1 and A2 take hold of the arms. F1 and F2 take hold of the feet. Pretending to try and rescue S.H., 12 more with oak billies loaded with lead surround the group and rush to our carriage. One plagued in this way will not invite others. I'm gonna wrap up, but one of the fascinating things is Amos A. Lawrence. So Kansas becomes a gray state. Right, they have to vote on whether or not it's going to be pro-slavery or anti-slavery. And the governor of Missouri is sending Missourians in at night to sleep over in tents and vote pro-slavery in the morning. So Amos A. Lawrence finances thousands of people from Massachusetts to move to Kansas to vote yes. And Lawrence, Kansas, wow, is named after Lawrence, Amos A. Lawrence, Lawrence, Massachusetts, because they were indebted. And it actually made the difference because Kansas was a free state financed by this guy. I've got a whole bunch of his letters, poems about his letters, fighting. He writes letters to the governor of Missouri. He writes letters to other folks. And One big thing that happens is anyone know who this person is? It's a little hard to see. This is a young picture that I found at the Boston Athenaeum. If I showed you a different picture of him 30 years later, you would definitely know who he was, and I would never show it to any of my neighbors in Alexandria and Virginia because they have a different take on this guy than we do here in Boston. But this is John Brown. And Amos A. Lawrence financed John Brown to run raids to kick the guys from Missouri out, and he accidentally killed a couple of them, and that was the first time that he went on trial and went underground and found his way to Harper's Ferry. And he has letters that he wrote. Here's a letter that Amos A. Lawrence wrote to Franklin Pierce, the president of the time, asking for a real trial after Harper's Ferry because they were like, this guy's treason. He needs to just be burned at the stake. And Amos A. Lawrence writes to his friend, because he funded him too, President of the United States. This poem's called The Miles Standish of Kansas. Few people know of this man's real character. He is the last one to proclaim merit. He's a true Puritanic warrior, and I esteem the loss of his services. I bought wool from him back in 43, and I've known a lot more of him since. He has the look of a determined man. Captain John Brown is a Kansas hero. He beat Missourians at Osawatomie. At Pottawatomie and Harper's Ferry, he might have taken the higher law much too far, but regardless, he must be justly tried. From his blood will spring an army of martyrs, all too eager to die for liberty. Amos A. Lawrence then actually is the recruiter for the 54th Regiment led by Shaw. Recruiter meant that's you financed the thing. You paid for all of it. And the last poem I'll read is called The Last Full Measure of Devotion. My sword got stuck between his ribs. I kicked my foot into his chest. I pulled it out with both hands. In the same motion, I swung right into the gut of another. He hit the ground. I grabbed his Colt. I shot one who was charging me with a rifle and bayonet soaked with blood and blue cloth. Without the support of any kind, Captain said, retire by prolong, so McGlivery could fill the gap. We went quiet, and he said, hold position at all hazards. I thrust my sword even harder into a Mississippi thigh as he tried to kick it from my hand, then go after my best gunner. I used rammerheads. I used hand spikes. I kicked him in the groin. I kneed him in the face. Then I shot him in the stomach, and I shot him in the face. There was so much smoke around me, I didn't know their numbers. Too many Barksdale sharpshooters. Too many from South Carolina. Too many 21st from Mississippi. Too many rocks for our wooden wheels. Too many dying men and horses to move our Napoleons back. We saw Bigelow get shot twice, but the bugler took him to the rear. We kept on trying to fight. I got stabbed twice in the ankle. I felt the shell go in my side, but my eyes were open when I died. Thanks. So it's now my great pleasure. I won't lift this up to... It's now my great pleasure to introduce my friend and Danielle Legros George, who I've known since 1994. You say that I met you at the Joyner Center. Danielle is a pioneer of something that's now become famous, called that was going on in Boston in the early 90s, which is called the Darkroom Collective. A number of African-American and global folks from the African diaspora, inspired by Alice Walker and James Baldwin, who were getting together and creating a poetry movement. And myself and one of my friends went to one of our readings, and we both looked at this one and said, "This woman is serious." And she is so serious. And I say serious not in just a John Brown kind of serious, but she has a John Brown serious in her. But she's seriously funny. She's seriously filled with love. She's seriously filled with compassion and empathy, which all comes out in her poems. I'm a huge admirer of her. I always have been. Every magazine I've had, she's one of the first persons I call and say, "Can I stuff it with your work?" And she's made I can't pay the rent with this stuff, but this woman can. She's a professor of creative writing at Lesley. She published a great first book called Maroon, which is sort of a homage to Haiti and everything that was going on in the 1990s, her native country. She's published everywhere where you're supposed to and not supposed to publish in the literary world. And she's got a brand new book out that she actually has here. Mine comes out in a month or two, called The Dear Remoteness of You, published by Barrow Street Press. And she's got endorsements on the back from Edwige Danticat. I'm sure you've heard of her. Off of Michael Weaver, and Nick Flynn. I've always admired your poetry. I've always admired you as a person. And the city of Boston voted on it, and they voted her the Poet Laureate of Boston. She's the Poet Laureate of Boston. Succeeding another great Poet Laureate of Boston, who you guys are going to host here, Sam Cornish, as a fellow, which is terrific. And I've not only have I been an admirer of you seriously, but we've become great friends over it, and I'm super excited to share the stage with you. And this time I know I'm going to remember it because I'm drinking seltzer.
Thank you, KG, and organizers of this reading. It's a pleasure to be here in this space of great poetry with great poets around. Still life with orbs. Between the thing and the name of it is a world, and a world behind this world. There is my mask placed on the table. There is the wooden table and the space beneath it. There is an orange on the floor when it should be on the table in the yellow basket meant for oranges, but which contains a cat licking one front paw. What do cats know of oranges? What do birds know of water unless they plunge their beaks into it, breaking some poor fish's sleep? What do fish know of birds except the slash of bill, the sudden flash, the stop? I write about race. I find it an unavoidable subject as a black woman living in the United States. And that's not all I write about, but from time to time I'm compelled. So I'm just warning you that these poems are going to be about race. Poem from the real world. I'm on Dorchester Ave when I hear it. Nigger. It's September 28th. 2004, and I haven't heard the word used this way in so long. I am for some seconds stunned and simultaneously amused in the way an archaeologist might be coming upon the grotto of some long extinct tribe she's been studying for years to discover their swear words etched in the cave. And almost in the same moment, I say to myself, he's not talking to me, and keep walking. It's a temperate day, Indian summer asterisked for further study. Blustery, and again it comes, nigger. And nigger comes creeping slowly from his coffin, fettered, measured, lynched, raped, reconstructed, redlined, incarcerated, deconstructed, and resurrected. I would have preferred negress. More charming and bellatristic, more gendered, but past the purpose and grasp of the wielder of nigger. But I digress. And return to the task of inscription with what is available to me. That is language. There is no poetry here because there is no poetry here. I'm recording this to remind myself this wasn't an odd dream, the result of having watched one too many PBS documentaries on civil rights and race relations in the United States. Of imagining a young Linda Brown crossing the train switchyard to school, Topeka, Kansas, 1952. I'm recording this to remind myself that this did indeed happen on September 28th, 2004, in Boston, Massachusetts, my beloved Boston, the United States of America. I just want to say, Kevin, I so appreciated what your project is doing and its excavations. I'm just thinking about this because of I'm reading poems about race. So I just want to say that. I'm going to read a poem entitled I'm going to remember the title. Sometimes you write poems like a while ago and you forget the titles, or maybe I just forget the titles. I had the good fortune of having a residency at a large university in the Midwest, a wonderful university in the Midwest, and I was I would walk to the library and walk to the various other places in the university, and I would I was a sort of a black woman scholar, and then I would see other black people, some of them scholars, but then most of them security guards and people working on the, on campus. And I just started thinking about that, why the majority of the black people I saw were, you know, calf workers and security guards protecting the denizens of the university from other people like them. So,
can you speak up a little bit, Daniel?
Sure. And let me find the poem. It's called Poem of History. It's also my failed attempt at a really wonderful poetic form called the Ghazal. It's a Persian form with of couplets of a particular rhyme pattern, and I sort of started to get getting going with it, and then I realized I couldn't. But anyway, so it was initially called Ghazal of History, and then I had to revise it to be Poem of History. Okay. When living your life, you are not making history. Stepping out of your life, you make of it history. Jamal, doctoral student whose city apartment I've sublet, has gone this summer to Egypt to write a story which is and is not history. Gone before Egypt exploded in history, its leader pulled down like a kite by his people. Jamal in the foul, in the crowd as it opens its flag of history. Not amber, but action. A lamp glowing in shadows of history. Like the light of my lamp on Jamal's table-turned desk on which I write history. His apartment blurs in the heat of summer. White octagonal tiles and a clawfoot tub govern the bathroom. I draw water from the waters of history, cool and safe from the blood of history. I draw water from the sink of the kitchen, cool and clear for the lilies standing bright as stars on the table by the white wall and window. Outside the gray buildings, past the green plaisance, the university sprawls like a beast. How lovely its lawns, its evening lights, patrolled by dark guards drawn from the dark city periphery. An irony not lost on them, in inky corners posted, shielding the denizens of the university from others like them. Inside and out, the confines of safety, the black jungle, the gray jungle, the towers, the lush avenues, the colossal structures, the sources of knowledge, a dark flower, a guarding of history. We eat cold eels and think distant thoughts. We eat cold eels and think distant thoughts, said American boxer Jack Johnson, glistening like a fish, to the newsman who asked him why white women were drawn to black men like him. What is it like to eat cold eels and think distant thoughts? What is it like to be a black man who eats cold eels and thinks distant thoughts? What is it like to be a black man who thinks to say, we eat cold eels and think distant thoughts, to a white reporter, early 1900s America, who wishes to reduce him to meat? Once, in the Chicago Aquarium, a long time ago, I met an eel. I was told by the label on his large tank weighed 53 pounds and was 100 years old. It looked at me with such a fierce intelligence through the glass and silty water of its address. Its gray, bald head, almost human. Its two lidless eyes. Its small nose holes. And instead of a body below its head, no body but a tail of fluid form. one great muscle behind ears that were not ears, but also holes. Its whole body beating a slow, chilled rhythm that kept it afloat. And a cool terror shot through me as it watched me watch it. As it followed me through the liquid wall that split our worlds and separated our species. Only. Nature hides the most beautiful design, the norm, the anomaly, the rare, the rarest, which is to say, the only. And aren't we each twins even? Only. Light thief. I'm from the Global South, and I noticed this phenomenon in the Global South, and also parts of the American South, and areas of poverty too, of redirecting. Electricity, redirecting light. I thought, wow, what an interesting idea of like stealing light. And in Jamaica, it's called thieving light. So, light thief. I delight in dust and dimness. Slim as a suggestion. I slip up the light post to brightness. Slip a snare around its neck and send it sputtering down. I rip the gleam, archangel, my crime and making one. As a beauty queen takes all shimmer, to dimmer spots I'll go with it. I will fill a light bulb hung over a rough cradle. Shake a shadow from pure pitch, tunnel like a long-tail rat, make the darkness wail, make you see what the hell you're doing, what the hell you're in, all roaches and cat, all people and dead dog. I'm the deep turned demi-monde, I'm the black turned blue, I'm a shift in mood. The trash floating by the spit of the sea. I light it. Yeah, that's me. Your outlaw connection to sight. Your free, no charge vision. Your 30-watt shantytown glow. I'm going to read some poems about Haiti. We all witnessed the earthquake of 2010 and its devastation. And, you know, in it, more than 300,000 people lost their lives in a very brief moment. And many of those lives could have been saved, you know. And those people perished as a result of overcrowding in Port-au-Prince, as a result of structural violence, of a bad government, of interference in governmental affairs by what Haitians call the international or very powerful international interests, including, unfortunately, the United States. And so shortly after the earthquake, I was asked to write a poem for a magazine that would support relief efforts. And I found that I had very little to say in the face of that. You know. So I wrote a couple of poems. The first is called poem for the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. As I was watching, as I was following what was taking place after the earthquake, through the media, I was constantly hearing Haiti referred to as the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, as if it were its last name, its only metric. And I mean, I know Haiti to be much more complex than just that, and so I felt the need to address that stereotype. Not that Haiti does not struggle with poverty. Poem for the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. O poorest country, this is not your name. You should be called beacon, flame, almond and bougainvillea, garden and green mountain, villa and hut. Girl with red ribbons in her hair, books under arm, charmed by the light of morning. Charcoal cellar in black skirt, encircled by dead trees. You, country, are merchant woman and eager clerk. The grandfather at the gate, at the crossroads, with the flashlight, with all in sight. And the next poem, Intersection, which was the first poem I wrote and which I found very difficult not difficult to write, but, I was confronted with this idea or the feeling that I had very little to say. Intersection. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. Earth. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. Ash. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. Earth. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. I walked through it. I walked. The earth shook. A portal opened. I walked through it. I walked through it. The earth shook. A portal opens. I walk through it. The earth shook. A portal opens. I walk through it. Returning to the States, you will listen to me, New York. A man who built a voodoo shrine using his ex-girlfriend's underwear, then killed her mother and a dog, was sentenced Thursday to 28 years to life in prison. The ex-girlfriend, Françoise McDaily, 16, told police that Pierre Carunard, 36, harassed her after she broke up with him. On the day of the crimes, it is reported Carunard called her at work and threatened her mother, Espérance Labidou, a Haitian immigrant who worked at a bus company. Carunard later stabbed the mother 25 times in her home before he turned the knife on her Chihuahua, foo-foo. He then fled to Florida. Police found a shrine in his apartment made of McDaley's underwear and one of his socks tied together in a vine. Carol now explained in court that the shrine was a sort of spell to control her spirit. Police also found a letter in his apartment. "All I want to do is love you and make a life with you, but your family keeps getting in the way. Let this be the last interference. You will no longer listen to your family. You will listen to me. You will listen to me," part two. What you have just read or heard is a condensed transcript of a real news story. Man with voodoo shrine gets life in prison. No byline accompanies our titillating tale of murderous love. The wild pair of sock and underwear, vine of love. The breed ID dog, whose name in Creole sounds like crazy, crazy. The man stabbing the mother. This is crazy. The man knifing the dog. The story itself, a dog rummaging for a bone. And what of the girl? Only 16 to the man's 36. Here, the story doesn't blink. Should we write a new headline, leave voodoo alone, and continue to climb up this story's vine? Man with mental illness menaces family. Do not leave me, dear reader, as I dredge up the details. The awful facts. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and read some poems of non-love. How about that? Or perhaps lost love. Maybe that's the, sort of the better description. Arc. A lizard skitters across the pavement like a line across a page. Its meter trochaic, its demeanor grave. Green scale, break. A shift like a blink. A sun ray illuminates its almost mind. The mind we were, you and I. A unison of armor. A sidle and gleam. The city cold and brilliant. You inarticulately beautiful. The restaurant whose name we never could remember, in order to give it new names we could remember. Our winter sun that flashed and fell. Egg. Darling, you are an egg. There is no in, there is no out. The germ of you remains embraced. To free you would be to break you. To spread you over the black face of a heat to eat you. Then you would travel through me, through throat and entrails to earth, to the body of the earth, becoming more than you've ever seen and more than you have ever known. And I'll close with two poems. Which I hope can serve as the antidote to the non-love poems. Love spell number 8. I will watch you watch me. I will be the faintest beat, the tannest shade of heart, a pulse imperceptible. If your house has a middle post, I'm it. If your lake ripples only once, I am the sand grain dropped in it. Now, the this last poem is called Love Spell Number 6, and it's for mature audiences. I can find it. They say if you wake wet in the night, the devil's been visiting you. How else to define your grip on the bedpost, the steam your thighs give to the room's eyeless heat? They'll blame the pepper in the red stew if you want to, the meat marinating by the kitchen's cool counter. To catch a man, all a woman's gotta do is place the steak she's fixing to feed him between her legs when she's bleeding. Give that to him for a love so fierce, he'll murmur, "Sweet Jesus." Then forget about God. The Lord has nothing to do with this. I should tell you, I've never tried this recipe myself. So if any of you do or recommend it to a close friend or someone near you, please let me know. Thank you very much.
So much for your reading.